Mental health care can be difficult for many patients. It can be hard to properly diagnose the issues a person is dealing with, and in some cases even harder to find a proper treatment. The field of psychiatry has a long history of these struggles to identify and treat mental illness over the last 200 years, with mixed results at times and some shocking and traumatic treatments along the way. In a new book, our next guest documents that troubled history and how it shapes the way we treat mental illness today. He says there's no single solution for many people facing the most difficult kinds of mental illness, but there are changes we could and should make. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience yourself with mental health treatment? Did you find success with the methods you tried? Are you a caregiver, maybe for someone in your family who's dealing with some kind of severe mental illness? What kind of help do they and do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Scull is a distinguished professor of sociology emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is called Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
There's a running theme in your book of kind of overconfidence at different periods of history. In the early 1800s, asylums were going to cure 80% of mental illness. Then nerve tonics, then Freudian psychotherapy, then biology and pills, then cognitive behavioral therapy. You write in your conclusion, humility and open-mindedness are deeply desirable qualities. They're in short supply. That seems like one of the main points in your book. Do we need more humility in the scope of psychiatry?
Yes, I think we do. And I think as well, we need to beware of trumpeted statements that the cure is at hand. Unfortunately, there have been many of those in the past, as you've just illustrated very briefly. And all too often, with experience, we've learned that far from being helpful, they've often turned out to be extremely harmful. It's not that there's been no progress in the field, but we have no psychiatric penicillin. And even today, if you ask, do we understand where depression comes from, why people experience bipolar disorder, how is it that people become schizophrenic? The honest answer to that is we simply don't know. So we're kind of groping in the dark. We have some treatments that help symptomatically. They often come with a serious price to be paid for whatever relief they provide. And they're certainly far from being the kind of interventions that we'd like to see, since the degree of suffering of people with mental illness, and of course, the suffering of those around them trying to cope with the devastation this causes, is quite enormous. And so this is a very fraught area. Mental illness is far more widespread than we often think, until it affects ourselves or one of our loved ones or somebody we're close to. So this is an enormous problem. It's compounded by the stigma that seems to attach to the mentally ill and also to a degree to the professionals who try to treat them. And it remains a great mystery, I think, despite 200 years and large amounts of money being plowed into research. We're a long way from seeing solutions, which isn't to say there aren't things we could do better than we're presently doing. But being a little skeptical, exhibiting a certain amount of humility in the face of what is an awful set of problems is, I think, absolutely one of the keys to advancing from our present state.
You tell a 200-year story. I want to start a little more recently. The move, what did it start, 4 or 5 decades ago, to go from large-scale institutionalization of people with more severe mental illness to something else. And often you write very poorly thought out something else. Can you talk about that process and what it's meant for what we see today?
Yes, indeed. It's important to note that for about 100, 125 years, the United States, like most of the developed world, embraced the idea that the major solution to this, the problems of serious mental illness, was to lock people up in what were first thought to be therapeutic institutions. And that was founded in an atmosphere of great optimism about what these places could accomplish. By the end of the 19th century, that optimism had almost completely disappeared. And yet numbers institutionalized continued to grow very steadily. About 400,000 at the outbreak of World War II, 500,000 people in mental hospitals in a given day in 1950, about 560,000 in the mid-50s. And then slowly at first, and then quite abruptly from the late 1960s onwards, we abandoned that whole approach. And that came about in part by a rising tide of criticism of the mental hospitals as warehouses for unwanted people, as places that were anti-therapeutic by their very nature, that systematically dehumanized both their patients and staff. So there was a real rise in the criticism and a lot of journalistic exposés of the sad state of America's mental hospitals. Right after World War II, journalists who had visited Nazi Germany and seen the death camps, Dachau and Belsen and Buchenwald, came back here and visited America's back wards of its mental hospitals and described them in the words of one of the journalists as America's own death camps. So the reputation of mental hospitals fell drastically, and particularly from the 1960s forward, there was an argument that communities would be receptive to the mentally ill, that we had new treatments, particularly the new drugs that had come on the scene in the early 1950s, and that community care could substitute for institutionalization, and that would be a grand reform. It also not so incidentally promised to save a lot of money. Mental hospitals absorbed huge fractions of state budgets in the early 1950s. In New York State, for example, about 30% of the state current budget was spent on its mental hospitals. That was a huge slice of the money that states were spending. But the reality was that the community wasn't terribly receptive to the return of the mentally ill. The drugs were at best a very partial fix, and for many patients, they didn't work at all. And there was no real infrastructure built in the community to cope with the needs of people with serious mental illness, housing, social supports, some respite care, for example, for families. All of those things were largely missing. And in the excitement over getting rid of the snake pits, as a famous film of the 1940s had it, everybody assumed that anything that replaced the asylums had to be better. And we've learned from bitter experience that that's not the case. I split my time between San Francisco and San Diego, and I occasionally visit LA and New York City, and everywhere I go, the problem of homelessness, and while that's not exclusively a problem of the mentally ill, a large fraction of those on the streets are suffering from serious mental illness. And what we've created is a system where many patients move from the gutter to the flop house to the jail, occasional contact with psychiatry for the prescription of drugs, which they often don't take, and then back out into the street, and the whole cycle repeats and perpetuates itself with horrible consequences for the lives of those people, and also severe consequences for our general well-being and the state of our cities and even our rural communities as these problems fester and multiply.
Talking to Andy Scull, author of the book Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Whitewater. Tom, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My concern with this topic is just that this has touched my family before, and I currently belong to a number of support communities in Wisconsin where people are experiencing this. And the lack of a whole body look at mental illness is something that's come up more than once. A number of the people that I've talked with who have finally gotten help, when they were dealing with mainstream medicine, no one ever looked to see, did you have a brain injury before? Do you have food allergies? Do you have chemical sensitivities? Is there some other biochemical cause for your mental illness difficulties? They were simply placed on prescription medications to suppress their symptoms with the hope that it would do something, and they didn't achieve recovery that way. It wasn't until there was a more whole body approach that they actually got stable and got some help.
Tom, thanks for the call. Andy, what do you think?
Well, I would agree. Psychiatry has, in the last four decades or so, become increasingly dependent on pharmaceuticals, on drugs as the sole and singular response to the problem of mental illness. And I think it's much more multifaceted than that. I would respectfully disagree a bit with the caller in the sense that I do think that we simply don't know enough about the origins of mental illness to confidently say, oh, it's diet, oh, it's stress, oh, it's abnormal brain biochemistry. It seems to me this is an enormously fraught and poorly understood area, but I would agree with him that coping with the problem has to go beyond simply prescribing antipsychotics or antidepressants, has to take account of the social circumstances of the person and of the family, very often who is trying to cope with an enormously stressful situation. So in that sense, the pressure to adopt a broader approach to the problems of mental illness is one I would heartily endorse.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Andy Scull. His new book is Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. You can join in with your questions for our guest, maybe share your own experiences as someone dealing with mental illness and trying to find treatment, a family member, or a treatment provider. What support do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Andy Scull, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, San Diego, talking about his new book, Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to thank the professor for being on today, and I just want to say I'm one of the founding members of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the founding president of NAMI Wisconsin, and a founder of NAMI Dane County. One of the things that it is important, I think, to be discussed is the implementation of assertive community programs. And PACT, the Program of Assertive Community Treatment, out of Mendota, here in Madison, Wisconsin, is celebrating its 50th year. My son is a client of that program. That is, in a sense, a wraparound program which has shown, it's demonstrated through the decades, what it can do to help individuals with serious and persistent mental illness in the community. And I would say the track record has been excellent. My son is now 66 and a half. He worked for 20 years part-time at the Mental Health Center. He gave over 750 educational talks about mental illness. He has been, quote-unquote, compliant with medications through 48 years and 45 years as a client of PACT. So we do know how to treat persons quite effectively within the community, and it has been demonstrated and continues to be demonstrated. here in Wisconsin, and there are assertive community treatment programs around the country.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And Andy, you're right. You know, sometimes we focus on, will this pill cure or this version of talk therapy cure someone? You also, I think, want to see more focus on community and helping people, even if they're not quote unquote cured, live good lives in a community.
Absolutely. Nancy, thank you for that call. And indeed, you know, we certainly need more in the way of community support programs of the sort you describe. Wisconsin actually modeled quite early on in the deinstitutionalization process some of these programs. And as model programs, they were quite successful, at least if one can rely on the published data. The problem is that these sorts of supports are in incredibly short supply across the country. So people who are fortunate enough to get those kinds of services may do rather well, but as a general principle, this is not what people with severe mental illness experience, or their families come to that. So yes, more social supports, more help with sheltered housing, more help with the sense of social isolation that often accompanies mental illness. All of these things would be a distinct step forward from the situation we face now.
Nancy, thanks for that call. We'll go to Virginia now in Milwaukee. Virginia, hi.
Hi to both of you. I'm so really grateful that I just came into my apartment and heard you on the radio, and I thought, I definitely have to get in on this conversation. My daughter is, she just did turn 63, and she looks like she's about 55 or something. I guess we just have that youthful look in her family. I don't know. But she was headstrong to be a model. And I have her beautiful professional modeling picture in her room. She's in a group home, and this is the thing that has saved her. She was like so many other people who have this, I call it a monster on your back. And you can't get it off, but you can tame it. And how they tamed it with her, fortunately, the medical community, with trial and error through the years, have found that some medication does work. And of course, it's also the talk therapy, I think, too. So she had a fall, and it was a life-threatening fall. So you might say she was dead and hit her head on the cement. And she was living at large, you know, like some of the people were turned out from the behavioral health here in Milwaukee. And for whatever reason, thought that they could live on their own. And of course, my daughter could not. She always got herself into some kind of problems or whatever with other people or whatever.
I understand, Virginia, we don't have too much time left. But Virginia says the solution, Andy, wasn't medicine or talk therapy or a group home. It was a combination of a lot of different things. And it sounds like a long time of trial and error.
Well, I think trial and error is an accurate assessment of what we often confront, professionals confront in trying to deal with mental illness. There are a wide range of medications out there. All of them have both some advantages and a great deal of drawbacks. Which one is going to suit a particular patient is hard to know in advance. And the same thing is true of forms of talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and the alternatives to it. So, you know, in the face of a great deal of lack of knowledge about how to proceed, one does the best one can. And indeed, I think that's an accurate assessment of how things go. For many patients, unfortunately, none of these interventions work very well. If you're fortunate, and I hope this caller's daughter is fortunate in that respect, things are better than they otherwise might be. But we all would love the day where we had a cure for these awful conditions. Unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Virginia, thanks for that call. Andy, we have just a minute or so left. There isn't a magic cure for many forms of mental illness. There's not a magic cure for the system. But if there were one change you could communicate to people who, you know, provide the funding, what would it be? What is the most important element that we could change right now?
I think for the last 40 years, particularly the last two decades, there's been a singular emphasis on the biological dimensions of mental illness that unfortunately has had very little in the way of actual therapeutic payoff. So what I'd like to see is a more broad focus on how we proceed from here that takes account of the environmental, of the social, and of the psychological, as well as continuing to do basic research, because for certain forms of serious mental illness, I would be astonished if they didn't turn out to be a biological component, but we don't know what that component is right now. And putting all our eggs in one basket is a bad recipe, I think.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
That's Andrew Scull, Distinguished Professor of Sociology Emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He joined us today to share his research, his latest book. It's called Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness, looking at over 200 years of mental health treatment in the United States, the promises, and where it's gone wrong.